most of the things that Lewis liked, he developed those tastes by the time he was 16.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty. I'm the author of two books, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, and an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters entitled C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. On today's show, my guest is Dr. Harry Lee Poe, who's known as Hal to his friends. He's back to tell about the first of three books about the life of C.S. Lewis he's written. The initial one, just released in the fall of 2019, is entitled Becoming C.S. Lewis. It explores the early life of someone best known for writing the Chronicles of Narnia and books about the Christian faith. As you'll hear in a moment, Hal provides a detailed examination of Lewis's formative years and shows how it impacted his later life. So, how well do you know Lewis, known as Jack to his friends? Find out as I ask Dr. Poe about Becoming C.S. Lewis, which covers his first 20 years. Many people think they know C.S. Lewis because they've read some or all of the Narnia books and or the books related to the Christian faith that he's written, but it seems like the angle of Becoming C.S. Lewis is one doesn't know Jack unless they understand his life growing up. Why is that?
Lewis had an interesting, to say the least, childhood. He was very close to his mother. She died when he was 9. And then the way he described it, he was shipped off to concentration camp, you know, without benefit of trial by jury and violation of Magna Carta. Now, there he was in this dreadful English school presided over by someone who, in fact, was certifiably insane. He had been declared insane by a court a couple of years earlier. And so it was a pretty rugged experience of childhood, and yet during that childhood and into his adolescence until he went away to war in 1917, C.S. Lewis developed most of his preferences, his tastes, what he liked, what he hated, the things he enjoyed and took pleasure in, the things he would avoid if he possibly could. And because of this, during his teenage years, he actually developed what would become the basis for his career as a literary scholar, as a teacher of English literature. And these years also formed the basis for the pathway to his conversion. That is, what he did during his leisure time, reading the great books of the Western canon. That's what he did for pleasure before there were video games and the internet and TV and movies. He read, and what he read allowed him to have a career in English literature, but also created the longing, the desire, the satisfaction that formed the pathway for his conversion. And I think those who read Becoming C.S. Lewis and already know something about what he would write later in life will make the connection even as they're reading the book before I make the connection for them.
Now, how did you come up with the idea for this book? Did you like wake up one day and realize C.S. Lewis's younger life can fully explain his views and ideas that came later?
This is one of those accidental books I never intended to write. In fact, this is my third book on Lewis, and I had not intended to write any of the others. But I was curious one day about what Lewis liked to eat. I was reading something, comment he was making about how much he enjoyed eating, and I'd seen him make that kind of comment several other places, and I thought, well, what actually did he like to eat? I didn't remember him ever talking about specific menus or his favorite food or anything like that, and I thought, well, maybe I could glance through his letters and see if he ever mentions a meal that he particularly enjoyed. And I started at the beginning, his childhood. And his real letter writing started, of course, when he went off to school. And page after page after page, he will talk about having had a good meal, but he doesn't say what it was. And the first entry that actually mentions a specific food item was when he went at the age of, well, in 1914, just before he turned 16. He went to Great Bookham to live with W.T. Kirkpatrick, who became his tutor to prepare him for scholarship examinations to Oxford. And for breakfast in the morning, Mrs. Kirkpatrick baked good old Irish soda bread. And he raved and raved about good old Irish soda bread. But by that point in the reading of letters, I had realized, oh my goodness, most of the things that Lewis liked and most of the things he hated, he developed those tastes by the time he was 16. Hmm. And I thought, well, my goodness, this is the story of how Lewis developed into the person he became. And it's things that affected his whole life as an adult. And so I thought, well, I'm going to give this a shot and see if this isn't, in fact, an important story to be told.
Okay. Well, now, technically, the first 20 years of his life is addressed in your book, but you really jump in around age 10. In fact, your first chapter starts there and covers just before his 12th birthday. Well, what stood out to you as some of the most significant aspects impacting young Jack Lewis at this time?
And I do start with the death of his mother, and he goes off to school. Then there's a flashback to his earlier years at home and the kind of home he grew up in. I think for both for him and for his brother Warney, that first school experience that both of them hated so much, and they begged their father to let them come home. And we wonder, why was he so brutal in not letting them come home? He had wanted them to go to an Irish school to begin with, but Mrs. Lewis, Flora Lewis, had great ambitions for her children. And Mrs. Lewis came from a more upper-class background than Albert Lewis did. Albert Lewis's family had come up by their bootstraps and were rising bit by bit in Ireland, whereas on Flora's side of the family, she was descended from nobility, related to baronets, a marquis. Her immediate family was several generations of clergy. Her grandfather was a bishop. And her favorite cousin, who would play a big part in Lewis's care after Flora died, was the wife of a baronet. So she had great social ambitions for her sons, and in those days it was absolutely critical that anyone who had ambition at all had to attend an English school, not an Irish school, and their Irish accent had to be beaten out of them. And that is essentially what happened to Lewis, not figuratively, but literally. It was a brutal school. And what we discover in those first few years at that first school is that Lewis hated the English, and the English hated him because he was less than human. He was Irish.
Well, now, before going on with the actual content, one of the things that you include, which is not unusual for biographies, is that you do have pictures of Lewis and his family and actually some scenery related to Lewis. Go ahead and mention some of them and how you went about selecting them.
I had been looking for these kinds of pictures, background pictures, for a number of years. I have a Lewis collection that I put on exhibit at libraries and universities around the country to spur interest in Lewis. And I look for original photographs from the period. So a picture of a photograph of Malvern College when he was actually at Malvern College, pictures from Great Bookham and the surrounding neighborhood from when he was actually there. I wanted people to see what was it like when Lewis was there. And the publishers, Crossway, also wanted to be sure we had pictures of Lewis with his family. And, of course, those are rare. And I appreciate the help of the Wade Center at Wheaton College for making available some photographs that actually tie in specifically with the book. And so there's an account of Lewis and his brother and father visiting Scotland on vacation. And we actually have a photograph of that vacation down on the beach in 1911. Of course, on the beach, in the sand, everyone wearing a coat, a tie, and a hat. So it's a bygone day, not the way most of us go to the beach. Then there are some important photographs I found of Oxford, and a few of these are in my collection. There's a picture of the officer training corps in a lecture in Oxford during World War I, and there on the back row, back full row, fifth from the right, is Cadet C.S. Lewis, and sitting next to him is his friend Patty Moore. Then we also have the back paste downs of the book right on the cover, a photograph of the full cadet corps that was stationed there at Keble College, and Lewis appears in that photograph. So there are a few images that people would not be familiar with, including the one on the cover of young Jack Lewis with a walking stick right at that critical age of I believe, 10 years old, right after his mother had died and he's off at school. So I appreciate Crossway making it possible to have some of those photographs in the book.
Well, now, getting back to what you wrote, while you've noted that the early years shaped Lewis, let me highlight the fact that you spend, if I did my math right, about 30% of your content covers up to the start of 1914, when Lewis was not yet 16. Talk about other aspects of how most of his tastes and views were newly formed by this time.
Yes, well, he hated sports, that is organized sports, team sports, and he was taught to hate them at school. As when they were children, they seemed to have enjoyed, he and his brother Warney, seemed to have enjoyed playing, and initially Warney was going to teach him all about cricket, but they both had a problem with their thumbs. Their thumbs were not fully jointed, which meant they were clumsy and couldn't catch or throw a ball, and this clumsiness carried over. It affected other aspects of their ability to perform on the playing field. And in English-speaking countries like ours, if a boy cannot throw a ball, hit a ball, kick a ball, dribble a ball, they have no validity to exist. They are they don't count, and they are severely ridiculed. And young Jack Lewis had to endure all of that. And he would go on to say that his experience of school because of the sports was more dreadful to him than the trenches on the Western Front in France. Now, a lot of his contemporaries thought that that was just an outlandish statement. And one of the his cohorts at school went on to become a knighted air marshal who did very well at school. And he said, well, things were wonderful at school. Well, of course they were for someone who was an air vice marshal and received a knighting from the king. But for Jack Lewis, It wasn't until he was in the trenches of France that he experienced camaraderie. And so he actually experienced grace in the misery of the massive death. And there he was accepted. And there he was able to perform heroically and courageously. He was wounded in action. He was decorated for valor. And so, of course, the school was worse than the warfare for Jack Lewis. And so these were that sort of thing developed his hatred of organized sports. At the same time, he was very athletic, and during his school days is when he discovered that he loved to take walks, 10-mile walks, 30-mile walks. Yeah. He would go prancing across the countryside in full stride for miles and miles and miles, and he just adored it. And that was when he was at Malvern. He hated mathematics because his headmaster at that first school, it was like being in a Dickens story, would beat the boys. He was the math teacher at the school, and he would beat the boys senseless whether they got the answer right or wrong. And so he just hated math. A colleague of mine here at Union, Matt Lunsford, has written a paper on the fact that Lewis demonstrates a high mathematical mind. And you see that in a number of things that he writes. Of course, his mother was a graduate in mathematics from Queen's College in Belfast, one of the very early female graduates of British college. So she had obviously a mathematical mind. But it's the idea that sometimes your professor, your teacher, your school experience can turn you against something you might ordinarily have enjoyed. So we've got those sorts of things going on. But also, in this solitary world, he discovered he loved stories. And so it's the reading that transported him and gave him pleasure, apart from when he could not find that kind of pleasure in friendship. So remember, it was not until 1914, when he was 15 years old, getting ready to go off to be a live-in guest with W.T. Kirkpatrick, that he made his first friend. He had acquaintances. He knew boys in school. But he realized there's something that friendship is different from just knowing people. So he'd had a solitary existence, and in that he found pleasure in reading and in stories.
Now, obviously you cover a lot more in the last two-thirds of your book. Let's consider the fact that you actually devote three chapters to the rest of 1914, chapters 3 to 5. What are some key events or people that helped shape Lewis during this time?
Well, 1914 is particularly important. It's when his father finally relented and said, okay, you don't have to stay at Malvern College anymore. We'll turn you into a sociopath if we keep you there. So there was a lot of writing back and forth between Jack's father, Albert, and his brother, Warren, about the best thing to do with Jack. And they were really concerned about him. They thought, oh, he was going to go around the bend. So it was agreed that he would leave Malvern and go to study with W.T. Kirkpatrick, who had been Mr. Lewis's schoolmaster when he was young. And he had also taken Warney under hand and prepared him for his entry exams to Sandhurst, the military academy. So that was the first important thing. Second important thing, during the Easter vacation that year, he became friends with Arthur Greaves, the boy that lived across the street. Now, they'd known Arthur for years and avoided him. He was older than Jack. He was the same age as Warney. They didn't want anything to do with him. Jack Lewis was a bit of a snob when he was a boy. Words like prat and prig are common terms that the English use. Stuck up is something we would say. intellectual snob is the sort of thing, and it's most unattractive in a child. And so an awful lot of civilizing had to take place with C.S. Lewis growing up. And one of those civilizing influences was Arthur Greaves. And what they found to have in common was a love for Norse mythology. And this created a bond. They were very different people. And but this common interest was one that overcame the differences. And Lewis, for the rest of his life, confided in Arthur Greaves in a way that he did not confide in anyone else, including his brother, or Owen Barfield, or J.R.R. Tolkien. The only person who would have come close to it would have been his wife, Joy, late in life. But most of what we know of Lewis in these unpublished years comes from the letters that Arthur Greaves preserved, and they give us a detailed account of what Lewis was thinking and feeling and reading and doing, what he loved, what he hated. So that's the second thing, this relationship with Greaves. The third thing that happened in 1914 was actually going to Great Bookham there in Surrey. And there's a famous conversation that takes place between Lewis and Mr. Kirkpatrick when he arrives at the station, and Lewis attempting to make small talk, which he hated. He wasn't good at small talk, and he hated small talk, but he makes an odd remark. He was surprised at how wild Surrey was, and so Kirkpatrick launches into him, essentially teaching him to examine his presuppositions and his assumptions. What grounds did he have for thinking Surrey would be wild or not wild? Had he read books? Had he been to Surrey before? Had he heard people talk about it? And so Lewis was excited by this new rational, intellectual approach, just as a boy's intellect is reaching that stage when they can think conceptually and at a deeper level than earlier life. So it was just what he needed. But the interesting thing is Lewis did have grounds for being surprised that it was wild, because Great Bookham is the town where Jane Austen sets her novel Emma. Jane Austen's cousin married the rector in Great Bookham. And so she visited there, and this is where she set Emma's story. And an important moment happens in Emma when the rector's new wife comes to town, and she says, "I've always said Surrey is the garden of England," to which Emma replies, "I think not." But it's a joke, because Surrey is a wild place, it's the sort of thing you would expect way up in the moors, or way in the wastelands of the Highlands of Scotland, or Dartmoor, or something like that. So all of this is happening. This new wild place was charming to Jack, because until there, he hadn't really seen any English countryside he liked. He just didn't like England. It was drab countryside compared with Northern Ireland, and it was full of the English. Mr. Kirkpatrick was not English. He was from Northern Ireland. Mm. And so this third thing that happened, the meeting with Kirkpatrick, began what can only be called hero worship. And this often happens with teenagers as they are distancing themselves from their parents. They are looking for older people to emulate, adulate, and Lewis bought into Kirkpatrick hook, line, and sinker. He loved the rationalism, but the other thing about Kirkpatrick is that he provided Lewis with a rationale for his atheism. the teenager is part of his rebellion against a father that he thought was just insufferable and a fool, distanced himself from his rearing. Remember, his grandfather was the rector of the local church they attended every week. And so he drifted into atheism, but Kirkpatrick, who was an atheist and a materialist, provided him with the rationale for it all. And so in the next few years, Lewis read deeply in materialist philosophy of various stripes that Kirkpatrick exposed him to. Kirkpatrick would talk to him at length about naturalism and natural selection, evolutionary philosophy, that sort of thing, so that Lewis was thoroughly acquainted with this way of thinking. And without that, he probably never could have written books like Mere Christianity or Miracles or The Problem of Pain. That is, he knew it from the inside. He knew the skepticism from the inside. And so the fourth thing that happens in that that year, 1914, he begins his lessons with Kirkpatrick and learns what a tutorial is. Now, Lewis was famous for his tutorials, and the Oxford method of teaching is not that students go to class and take lecture notes and have tests. The Oxford method of teaching is that you visit your tutor once a week for an hour. At that meeting, you will bring an essay you've been assigned, and you will read the essay to your tutor, who then takes it apart, and you as well, for good measure, and then puts you back together, and then sends you off with your assignment for your next essay and the books you should read in preparation for that essay. And it's one of interrogation in which the student is defending themselves. It's like defending a doctoral dissertation every week. And so Lewis was learning to think critically. He was learning to recognize his own presuppositions, but from Kirkpatrick, he was learning how to teach the tutorial method of instruction. And so all of those things became foundational for who Lewis would be once he grew up and started teaching at Oxford and went through the crisis that we no, was his conversion to faith in Jesus Christ.
Well, let's change gears a little bit and consider for a moment the fact that probably not every listener knows much about Dr. Harry Lee Poe. So take a couple of minutes to share about yourself.
I hold the Charles Colson Chair of Faith and Culture at Union University. Chuck Colson established this chair back around 2000. Because he liked what I was doing in terms of the integration of faith and learning and dealing with primarily how the gospel intersects culture and answers all the deep questions of culture. Chuck and I met at the C.S. Lewis Summer Institute in 1998 in Cambridge when he sat in on my afternoon seminars on apologetics in a postmodern age. I've written, this book makes my 18th book, and I write on the intersection of the gospel and culture. This is my third book on Lewis. I've done four books with Jimmy Davis, a colleague in the chemistry department, on science and faith. I've written a good bit on Edgar Allan Poe, who most people don't really know Poe. They know the mythology of Poe, but Poe's conversion experience is mirrored by Lewis. They essentially were asking the same questions and reaching the same conclusions in exactly the same order, including Lewis's right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. Poe came up with that. He had a different writing. It's called The Mystery Story. And I've explored a lot of those issues, and how do we evangelize a post-Christian culture? And so it's really a matter of going back to the Book of Acts and the early church, We've all been there before. The church has been there before. The Holy Spirit has been with us through the whole rigmarole. So those are kinds of issues I write about. I've done a good bit on Lewis besides these three books, a number of articles and chapters and reviews. And in fact, my very first reviews that I wrote as a scholar in an academic journal were those books that were coming out in the late 1970s and into the early 80s, The Inklings book by Humphrey Carpenter, Walter Hooper's lovely little book full of pictures, Beyond Joy and Beyond, Margaret Mead's diaries of Warren Lewis. So I was always interested in Lewis because Lewis had a sense of how to speak to the culture, swishing away all the presuppositions and assumptions and trite phrases and connecting to the culture in a way from their perspective so that the gospel made sense. And so I've always taken it as a model.
Oh, very interesting. Well, now, returning to your book, which is again entitled Becoming C.S. Lewis, the remaining chapters still cover many significant events and people. Of those, share just a couple that you believe the listener will especially find interesting.
Well, I think his experience in going up to Oxford is fascinating, and just the struggle to find a place in Oxford. And in Oxford, you are admitted to the university, but you can't go unless you also get admitted to a college. And and the question was, which college? And he thought about Christ Church, but his father and his tutor thought Christ Church would not be good because it's full of aristocrats and very wealthy people. He needed a place where he wasn't going to be overshadowed and outclassed. And so he wound up going to University College. And at the beginning of the war, there would have been more people there, but by the time he went in 1917, there were just a handful of people still in college, and these tended to be people who, for one reason or another, could not serve in the war. They were sickly, had various ailments and infirmities so that they were not fit for service, or they were Irish, and there was an exemption for the Irish from actually serving in the war, but they weren't sure how long that was going to last. They were sure that by the end they were going to take everybody, and thus Jack needed to be an officer. Well, in the end, Jack decided on his own he was going to serve. And I think he decided that because of all of the romance he'd been reading, romance not love novels, but the romantic chivalric tradition of King Arthur and his knights and Homer in the Iliad and valiant loyalty and courage and that sort of thing. He was going to do his bit. So he decided he was going to sign up. But his father said, well, you've got to go in as an officer. You can't go in just as an enlisted man. First of all, because of social standing. His social standing would be ruined if he went in as an enlisted man. But also just the quality of life was better for an officer, except the life expectancy of a young lieutenant on the Western Front was about 15 minutes. So it was a very dangerous place for a young lieutenant. So all of that, I think, is fascinating in how he learned to be sociable in the Army and with the cadets before he went into the Army. And this is the same context in which he makes a number of friends, not in the sense that Arthur Greaves was a friend, but he's beginning to realize you can have different categories of friends, different degrees of closeness. And Paddy Moore is one of those people that he knew. He wasn't taken to Paddy Moore. He didn't think much of Paddy Moore. He thought Paddy Moore was pretty dull. There were other fellows that he liked a whole lot more, and Paddy Moore was just sort of tagging along. And all of that changed when Lewis met Paddy Moore's mother. And so it wasn't that he took to Paddy Moore's mother because she was the mother of his deep friend, Paddy Moore. It's that Lewis took to Paddy Moore because he was the son of Janie Moore. And so it's a fascinating how that relationship began. And there'll be more of that in Volume 2 because we don't get to an interesting situation until after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. In fact, this is the first book that's going to be a series. You're going to cover his middle years for second. And do I understand correctly that there'll be a third and final so we know what happens to the rest of Jack?
Yes. Crossway is committed to publishing the full series. So the second volume will be the making of C.S. Lewis from atheist to apologist, 1918 to 1945. So we'll go through the end of World War II with that second volume. The third volume is the completion of C.S. Lewis from bachelor to widower, 1945 to 1963.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, before wrapping up, tell us briefly about three events that you were involved in which two that are very Lewis related.
Well, if your listeners are interested in Lewis, I assume they are, but also his friends, the Inklings, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, Lord David Cecil, Warney, and their friends, such as Dorothy L. Sayers, we have a retreat every spring in Montreat, North Carolina, high in the Smoky Mountains. Well, they call them the Smoky Mountains locally, but we know better. They're the Misty Mountains, actually. And it's not really Montreat, it's Rivendell. It's an absolutely gorgeous place, absolutely breathtaking to be there. So it's a destination. And the destination, I think, means a lot about your experience there. So it's a weekend centered around some theme connected with the Inklings. And we do that every year. Then something else we do every year is an academic conference for Christian professors to present papers on their discipline from a Christian perspective. This is sometimes called the integration of faith and learning, but it's thinking about your discipline from the perspective of faith. And then every third year, we go to Oxford for an Inklings Week in Oxford. And again, we'll take a major theme and have Monday through Friday, two plenary sessions every morning, then a worship time each morning with a speaker. And then between the two plenary sessions, we'll have what we call second breakfast. And this won't be food for the stomach, but food for the heart. And it might be something artistic, might be something funny, something clever, but something to touch the other side of the brain than just the intellectual side. And then the afternoons are free to explore Oxford and the surrounding countryside, go out and visit the country that Lewis loved so much, take a short hour trip over to Winchester or up to Stratford-on-Avon or into London for a show that night. And then in the evenings, in the summertime, the Oxford colleges have plays. There are usually two or three Shakespearean plays going on, and one or two revivals of Oscar Wilde or some other play. So there's lots of theater in the evenings, concerts, plenty to do. So the Inklings Fellowship is our name, and we have a website, www.inklingsfellowship.org. We'd love to have you join us for any of those three events.
And I'll have a link in the show notes for people to be able to follow. Let's go ahead and close out here by having you give us a final summary of why the reader will want to consider getting a copy of Becoming C.S. Lewis.
If you've read Lewis, if you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, if you've read any of his more scholarly works like The Allegory of Love, or any of his popular works like The Four Loves, you will find in this biography of his early years the germ for most of what he did in the rest of his life. He had his first vision of Narnia when he was 16 years old in the snow in Great Bookham, when he first had the image of a fawn carrying some packages through the snow with an umbrella. And so much of Narnia emerged from the countryside and the reading he was doing when he was in Great Bookham. The idea of the Four Loves, he's exploring in letters with Arthur Greaves about love and beauty and some of these great values that philosophically he could not fit into a materialistic world. There are no such thing as values if there's just a material world, and that would essentially be the beginning of mere Christianity. So as you read Becoming C.S. Lewis, you will see what kind of experiences in reading and developing mind would have Mere Christianity and the Chronicles of Narnia as their trajectory. We've looked at it from the perspective of C.S. Lewis. To turn it around, is there a practical value to it? I think every church struggles with youth ministry. Mm-hmm. And C.S. Lewis would be an example of someone who might have been overlooked by the church. And in fact, the church might have said, well, good riddance to bad rubbish. And I hope people who are interested in youth ministry will take a look at the book and begin to realize what are those key things that need to happen in early adolescence, middle adolescence, and late adolescence to help someone grow up, mature, and receive the gospel. So I hope that this book might be an aid to understanding what teenagers go through and the kinds of questions they ask that often the church doesn't want to deal with, but that we have to deal with because they are going to be asking those questions.
Oh, very good. Yeah, that's a different angle. I hadn't thought about that. All right. Well, Hal, well, thanks again for being on All About Jack.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks also goes to you, the listener, for your interest in my podcast, All About Jack. I hope you'll consider buying a copy of Becoming C.S. Lewis. And to help you do that, I have a direct link in my show notes to make it easier for you. You'll also find a link in my show notes to the Inklings Fellowship Group that Dr. Poe mentioned in the interview. Speaking of those notes, so you can find them at essentialcslewis.com and look for this show, but it also could be easier to locate the notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. At either location, you can find various podcasts, which typically feature interviews to authors of books about Lewis, but I've also done an occasional series about a specific Lewis essay, as well as a special series on Why Read Lewis, among other shows. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link and consider rating my show there, as well as sharing this podcast with others. Before ending, let me also remind you again about the two books I've published. The most recent is called The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. It explores 75 questionable quotations and talks about why you shouldn't share Lewis quotes unless you know he really said them. I also reveal the closest things Lewis said related to the questionable saying, which I examine, and relate the fun I had tracking the quotes down. I have also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. You can learn more about that book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Purchasing either of my books is a great way to indirectly support this podcast and to make sure it remains freely available.
Also, there is a link in the show notes where you can find the latest sales on Lewis books, as well as his books in general and books related to him. Purchasing through this link also helps support me. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.